Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel for this Thursday morning. It is the 21st of September, and it's a delight to have you here and joining us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have a great panel for you. Let me introduce them to you, and then we will get started on the news of the day. Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick is here. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe. Nice to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. It's been a little while. We love when you're here, so thank you for being here. We also welcome back Vera Carias-Kelly, a professor of political science at Siena College, and she will tell us this, but it's comparative political science.
That it is, but I'm really glad to be back, too.
It's
Thanks.
Wonderful to have you back. We love having you here. And, Teresa Bourgeois is back as well. Good morning. Communications consultant extraordinaire, and we welcome you.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you very much. All right. You are in for an interesting discussion because we have so many things that just make you go, huh? And which I guess has sort of been the norm, hasn't it? But we're going to try to get through as much as we can and figure out and hopefully add some substance to what we know is going on in our world. We will begin this morning, as I frantically look for my notes that I wrote out for today. There we go. I want to start with Bob Mueller seeking White House documents related to Trump's actions as president. The New York Times breaking the story, saying that Robert Mueller III, the special counsel, has asked the White House for documents about some of President Trump's most scrutinized actions since taking office, including the firing of his national security advisor and FBI director, according to White House officials. Mr. Mueller is also interested in an Oval Office meeting Mr. Trump had with Russian officials, in which he said the dismissal of the FBI director had relieved, quote, great pressure on him. The document requests provide the most details to date about the breadth of Mr. Mueller's investigation and show that several aspects of his inquiry are focused squarely on Mr. Trump's behavior in the White House. In recent weeks, Mr. Mueller's office sent a document to the White House that detailed 13 areas in which investigators are seeking information. Since then, administration lawyers have been scouring White House emails and asking officials whether they have any other documents or notes that may pertain to Mr. Mueller's requests.
So was anybody surprised by this? I wasn't particularly surprised. I given the fact that Mueller has this reputation for being thorough, kind of a pit bull in this realm, but I think maybe people were surprised that it happened so quickly, and also that it got out into the public. I thought this investigation was shut down and tight, you know, very, very tight, and weren't getting any news. Somehow this information is leaking out. I know it does focus or indicate that Mueller is looking at Trump, but I think that's just due diligence.
Well, and it would stand to reason, back to your earlier point, it would stand to reason that if that part of the investigation is an obstruction of justice in the firing of FBI Director James Comey, then of course it would go into what's going on within the Trump White House, correct?
Right. Do you think that the Trump White House is surprised?
I don't know how they could be.
No. I mean, the question is, who leaked the documents? And did the Trump White
For
House...
For what purpose, too?
Did the Trump White House leak the documents, or did who leaked the documents? Is Mueller leaking? Is the congressional folks leaking? Is the White House leaking? Who's leaking the
documents? So let's take an assumption that Mueller is not leaking.
Yeah. Correct. So then who does that leave? The
okay.
White House.
Right. And who within that White House would leak? Didn't we get rid of all the leakers? I'm just asking.
Yeah, or, I mean, also, I mean, there have been a series of leaks this week. There's the information that Manafort was threatened or was promised that he was going to be indicted. That apparently happened in July, but we're learning about it this week. So that happened this week. So, you know, it may be just a back channel. It may be just insiders, you know, politics about what's happening. But these things are being leaked for a reason, maybe.
The other interesting thing is also that the Russian press is obviously reporting on a number of things. And sometimes they also sort of release certain observations. So we knew from some of the Russian press coverage, as a matter of fact, about some of the things that may have happened to Manafort. So I'm sure there are translators at work all the time.
The other thing too.
Really interesting.
Well, the other thing too is that I said let's assume that Mueller isn't leaking, but it isn't to say that there aren't some lines that are being thrown into the water to say, okay, this is in what direction we're going in to try to ultimately, we saw this over the weekend in some articles in the New York Times and the Washington Post, of really putting the fear of God into the administration of, we mean business, this is serious, please comply or it's going to get worse.
You know, your idea that it may be the Trump White House is an interesting one, because I think his supporters will rally to him if they think, oh, yeah, Mueller is out. This is indeed a witch hunt. Mm-hmm. And so there may be some public interest on the Trump White House part to do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that there was anything in that list that was a surprise.
No.
The only thing that was surprising to me was the precision, the detail of what in the article, the level mm-hmm. of detail in the article, to me it was surprising. And if in fact, you know, Mueller has a reputation for not leaking, then in whose interest is it to leak? There was no new news there. But also it occurs to me, as we were talking about earlier this week, you know, there was a presidential tweet storm on Sunday. And, you know, as night follows day, usually when there's a presidential tweet storm, a few days later, you look back and say, maybe that's what he was upset about. Mm-hmm. And I think this, in combination with the Manafort story, may be the answer.
Hmm. So the Manafort story is one, and I welcome any of you to kind of put it into some sort of narrative for us, but we've learned many things about Paul Manafort this week. One, we learned that the investigation has been going on for a very, very long time, mm-hmm. 11 years, right? Mm-hmm. Is that into right. some of his yeah. of his activities? We also learned that as Teresa mentioned a moment ago, that he was almost promised an indictment. There was an early morning raid into his home. They broke the locks. They went in and got what they wanted to get.
And a storage facility.
And a storage facility. And uh-huh. they seemed to be spending a lot of time on his suits. Okay. And then the article in the New York Times today is that Manafort is working for allies of the leader of Iraq's Kurdish region to help administer and promote a referendum on Kurdish independence from Iraq, which the U.S. opposes the referendum, but Mr. Manafort has carved out a long and lucrative career advising foreign clients whose interests often have diverged from American foreign policy. Does that play into this narrative?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, you think so?
Yeah. I mean, I think with Manafort, if I were the Trump administration, you know, if the focus stays on Manafort, that's fine with them. The challenge is if it, you know, shifts from him to them. And the one thing that I found interesting, I was listening to conservative talk radio yesterday in the car, headed on a sea, and they were focusing on the wiretapping of Manafort, and saying that this is proof that the Obama administration was spying on a candidate for president, and how that was illegal, immoral, it was wrong. And their whole focus was not on Manafort's behavior, the potential implications of the Trump team, involvement of the Trump team in that behavior. It was all on the fact that their whole focus, their whole spin was the evil Obama administration breaking the law by wiretapping, eavesdropping on Trump and his campaign. But that ignores the fact that, as Joe, you just mentioned, that it began years ago, a long time ago, yeah, long before the campaign.
More than a decade ago.
Right. And under, one more quick thing, under a FISA warrant.
Right.
And so if you have a FISA warrant, there's a lot of layers of review before yeah. you're allowed to do that.
And we also know that for years, Manafort and his company has been under suspicion for, you know, taking foreign governments' money without disclosing. That's why, you know, we might joke about the photographs and the images they take of all his suits, but they can also calculate out how much money he has in assets in the house. They may have just picked up on the suits, but there are lots and lots of assets they can assess by these kinds of search in these kinds of searches. And we know he didn't disclose, Manafort didn't disclose all kinds of work he did in Ukraine. He was involved in potential money laundering, Russian money laundering money or money laundering issues, and also not disclosing payments from the Russians to undermine the Ukrainian government. So there are all kinds of issues for which the Obama administration already had a focus on Manafort.
And just help me with my math here, but if we're going back 11 years and that's true, that would go into the Bush administration.
Yeah, pre-Obama.
Yes, it would.
Yeah. Right. And so it also raises the question that's getting lost in this, which is why did the Trump team bring Manafort into their orbit in the first place?
As campaign manager.
As campaign manager, because it was not unknown that there were a lot of issues around Manafort and who he did business with.
Absolutely.
So what does that say about Trump and his team, that he would they would engage with this person who knowingly was engaging with the Russians? And then this new news about how leading up to and around the convention, he was in constant contact with folks, mm-hmm. including oligarchs that were very close to Putin.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to clarify what you just said, and just so I have it right as well, at the time when he left the campaign, and the narrative that the White House and especially the president has said, I believe the president said at one point when Manafort's name originally started to come to the fore as far as being the centerpiece of this investigation, as, oh, I barely know this guy. I don't mm-hmm. really know him. We had him on for a couple of days and he did his thing and then he left. But then you see a much closer relationship even after the official ties were severed.
Correct.
So the same arguments were used in terms of Carter Page, of course.
Yes.
Manafort is like Carter Page.
Well,
we barely know him.
That seems like a long time.
I know it does.
Like 6 months.
In fact, it's an entirely different situation. What Mueller is probably trying to look for is evidence that there has been an agenda by the Trump administration to bring in somebody like Manafort with connections, because he could be the sort of intermediary between the Trump administration and the Russian oligarchs / government. What we don't know, of course, is what the Trump administration may say. Well, we were unprepared to vet all these people and we didn't do a good job vetting. You know, those kinds of things have come up. But
of course, that is not very convincing.
Not very convincing, especially for people like us who pay attention to the details.
Yeah, the question about the current work, though, is what is his influence now, and does he have the administration's ear as he works in Iraq? I mean, what is the currency he brings to the table, and to justify him getting paid by this government? It's not illegal what he's doing, correct?
Can advise. You believe that? Whatever clients he wants.
He just needs to have some transparency in terms of registering with our government and mm-hmm.
proper. And I mean, I can imagine some of the listeners, eye rolling, saying, "Oh, what are you talking about? This? There's the Mexico earthquake, and there's the hurricane. And by the way, everybody's still at the UN. Very important meetings mm-hmm. today between
a mudslide in Sierra
President Trump and uh-huh. He's meeting with the Japanese and South Koreans today. But it does get back to this issue. I mean, Mueller will do his work, and the investigation mm-hmm. will go as it goes. But it does get back to the issue of what is our president's relationship with Russia and what impact that has. Because think of the role of Russia in the Ukraine mm-hmm. right now and those issues. Think about the role of Russia in the North Korea situation and the role that they could play and are not. And so I think all of those other issues are critical.
So I also wanted to mention, Russia is an essential player in the Syrian war. Russia is a grantor nation in the Iran agreement. So Russia is a very important member of the international community. And here we are trying to figure out, what exactly the relationships are, what has been agreed on.
North Korea, too, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, in essence, we have to really figure out what is going on and get to the bottom of this. We need transparency.
The thing, as we discussed, I was just thinking as we were talking about Manafort and sort of getting into the weeds a little bit as to what he's doing and what he's done and so forth. But you can't take that away from all of the other stuff, the meetings that Trump family members had with the Russians, the things that Trump said to the Russians in the Oval Office. I mean, you
and put said all, that he said,
and then he said that he said, and the reason that he even fired Comey. I mean, if you put all of that into the narrative, it does seem. Again, we have no idea what's going to come out of the Mueller investigation, but it does seem like there is a lot of smoke there, which I don't understand that not at least being acknowledged by the other side. But
I think one of the issues is there's so much smoke, and it's confusing to people that you're getting some fatigue and public interest.
Well, I'm there. I mean, I agree with that. But you, because you try to figure it out as to – because it's either incredibly complex or it's really easy and just stupid.
In fact, if you remember, Watergate got incredibly complex at some point and people started to zone out. But at its heart, it was simple. I think a lot of these things are very simple.
Right. Bad guy A did bad thing B.
Or tried to cover it up.
Right? And then tried to cover it up, right.
Right, it was a cover up. But the issue now is, what implications do those entanglements have for ongoing policy? The Iran deal.
Mm-hmm.
This is critical for all of us right now.
Yes, it is.
The U.S., our relationships with our allies, what happens in the Middle East. It's and so what are there undue pressures that Russia has on the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold there and take a pause. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on this subject. We'll include some letters as well. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to have you. We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Nice to have you with us. Vera Carius Kelly from Siena College is with us. Judy Patrick from the Daily Gazette, editor of the Daily Gazette, is here. And Teresa Bourgeois, communications consultant, joining us. Alan is off today. As you know, he had a back operation, but today's Rosh Hashanah, so he's off. But I do believe he'll be with us tomorrow morning. So. We look forward to that. Quick reminder on the lockbox. We've opened the lockbox and we're looking for money again because we want to get to the halfway point on the drive before we start the drive on October 16th. To help in that regard, we are offering a pair of tickets to the Capitol steps at the Egg on Friday, November 3rd at 7:30. So you get the pair of tickets, you get a CD recording of that performance, which obviously you get after the performance. Otherwise, you would just stay home and listen to the CD, and that doesn't work. So, pledge of $150, you get all of that. All the money goes into the lockbox. This is the fourth year we've done this in a row. All three prior have sold out, and this one is going on just about halfway to selling out in just a matter of 3 or 4 days. So, if you want to do this, now's the time to do it. All the money goes into the lockbox. It is very important for us, and we hope that you'll help us. It's WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Also, you can go to 1-800-323-9262 and just press 0, and someone will help you out there. But WAMC.org is the quickest and easiest way to do it. By the way, if you don't want to go see Capitol Steps and you only want to give us $10 or $5 or $1.50, that's fine. That all goes into the lockbox and is $1 or $30 or $50 less than we have to make during the fund drive. So we certainly don't want to leave you out. Whatever you can do. WAMC.org, 1-800-323-9262. All right. Let us get back to our discussion and what is happening. And so we were talking about the Iran deal, Donald Trump pushing to revisit the Iran deal and asking allies to help. And this comes, I don't know, I'm going to ask Vera this question. Do we have any sense during the
scary speech that was given on on Tuesday at the UN by the president, that kind of a clear path, and are we in any way going down a clear path now as to where we are in this agreement?
No, we have no idea, as a matter of fact, because when you think about it, five other countries are exceptionally important to this nuclear agreement with Iran. Germany, the UK, France are participants in the negotiations, or were participants in the negotiations, and then China and Russia are guarantor nations. So in other words, if President Trump wants to renegotiate or abandon this agreement, he can sort of attempt to do it, but in fact, this entire agreement cannot unravel without some element of renegotiation to which all of these different players agree to. So France already said, Macron already said, well, we're continuing to support this agreement. We might be able to add some elements to it. Theresa May already asked and requested what President Trump hopes to do. The answer was from the Trump administration that, you will find out. Let's see what happens. So no clarity there. So it seems to have been a very bellicose theater performance on the public stage. In addition to that, you have to think about who he was speaking to, his audience. Hundreds of diplomats and representatives of various nations were sitting there who had worked diligently for years to come up with this agreement. So in essence, people at the UN were sitting there thinking about how this is an absolutely ridiculous effort to undermine this agreement. Do we want an Iran that begins to behave like North Korea? Is that really where we're going?
So I know I'm asking for a lot here. I apologize. I know I'm asking for a lot. But explain to me the administration logic here then of, and again, I'm
sorry. He is asking for a lot, isn't he?
I'm sorry. But the logic as far as you see how quote unquote Rocket Man is behaving and that problem and how we are or are not dealing with that situation, of why we would then, is it not then at the very least hypocritical, at most just bizarre, that we would then bail out of an agreement that would help sort of get us to where we say we want to go?
So in many ways, I believe that the Trump administration has no clarity in its foreign policy overall. It seems to be the message of the entire talk was focused on the notion of self-interest, or what Trump said, I think, 21 times, sovereignty, exactly, the term sovereignty. So, America first, U.S. self-interest, when in fact the people he offended most were the closest allies with this kind of a talk. So what is it all about? It is about speaking to the base, perhaps, about how he sticks to his promises to reassert the argument that this Iran nuclear agreement has been the worst deal he's ever seen, when in fact this is a deal that has prevented certain elements of ballistic weapons to be developed and neighbors being threatened. And it has, of course, not solved all problems. I don't think we can expect that, especially not immediately, with an Iran that has been excluded from the international arena. And we're trying, using diplomatic means to get them back into conversations on how to have better relations with Iran.
Theresa Bourgeois.
Well, I have actually a question for listeners who may not understand the nuance, and you're an expert in this area. Why is it a problem for the President of the United States to go to the UN and talk over and over again about sovereignty? Why are people so concerned about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good point. Really, the largest annual international gathering of diplomats who believe in negotiating agreements, in overcoming war through peaceful efforts, through outreach, through communication. The UN exists to establish a system of allies, not to announce threats and potential warfare. So it was probably, for most people sitting in the room, quite appalling to listen to this. It sort of falls into, you know, categories. I mean, we made fun years ago of Ahmadinejad, you know, remember the representative of Iran talking in very bellicose terms, and the world was repulsed. Well, the UN is all about thinking through conflicts and developing agreed upon parameters to pursue peaceful resolutions to extremely complex international problems. And the U.S. administration doesn't seem to understand it or want to understand it or care.
And while people, countries, of course, come to the table focusing on their own interests, the idea is that, well, of course, you address your own interests, but if collectively you can, you know, knit together alliances, you are stronger in that way.
And while this is all very important, as a side note, I had a reader call up and cancel their subscription this week because we ran a New York Times story that talked in very clear terms about that UN speech and why it may not have been productive. And so his base that message was resonating indeed with his base. You know, one of my questions is, what is North Korea thinking the president wants North Korea to come to the negotiating table. If North Korea looks and sees what we've done with the Iran deal, are they saying, well, will they really negotiate in good faith?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly right. And so what the process question here is that by October 15th, the president of the United States has to certify or not that the Iranians are living up to the terms of the deal that was signed under the Obama administration in 2015. So this was reached not between the U.S. and Iran, but between a whole coalition of countries in the with the U.N. involvement and Iran. So this is a multi-party deal. And so he has to certify yes or no, are they adhering to it? And one of the interesting things that came up yesterday is that he said he's made up his mind, but he's not going to tell anybody. And so Secretary Tillerson was caught off guard because he was giving a press briefing and said, no, you know, this is still under consideration, when in fact an hour before, unbeknownst to him, the president had told other people, yes, he's made up his mind, but he's not going to tell anyone. But one of the speculations is that he will not certify that they're adhering to the deal, because then what happens is it goes back to the Congress.
Right.
And then in that way, he can keep his campaign pledge that it's a bad deal, but leave it on the Congress. But I thought it was interesting. Wendy Sherman, who worked for President Obama in the State Department, long time involved in global security issues, you know, she was saying, so what happens if he says that they're not complying? Then what's the next step after that? Are they going to go back to the negotiating table? No. And the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, he says they now have their money, and so in a way the toothpaste is out of the tube.
Yeah.
You know, he's saying, you know, you, and this is the Republican chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
Mm-hmm. Right. What can America do to sweeten that deal, to encourage them to reopen the negotiation? I don't know what they could do.
As you said, the key is, if the U.S. walks away from this deal, having walked away from the Paris Accords, who's going to negotiate with the U.S. while this administration is still in power?
The U.S. has nothing.
On anything.
The U.S. has nothing to put on the table on this one. They just have demands. And which other country will either believe the Trump administration or engage in complex negotiations at this point? This is a lose-lose.
And they have said that the Iranians have adhered to the letter of the agreement, but they're not adhering to the spirit of the agreement. Well, how would that work in a court of law in any contract?
Right.
Oh, well, you know.
Also, what I find profoundly depressing is when I think of all, I mean, the percentage of young people in the Middle East is very high, same in Iran. Many of them are very interested in being more involved in the international community. They want opportunities, access to education, the internet. Their great hope was that this nuclear arms agreement would in fact lead to a path for Iran to re-enter the international community. And here we are, one half of the population under the age of 30 in Iran will listen to this and say, what is this, another several decades of misery? I mean, what are we trying to do? Have a encourage, you know, revolutionary potential? Or do we like the hardliners in Iran to regain full control? I mean, what is our plan for Iran?
And maybe you can speak to this. If you open up a deal for negotiations again, you want Iran to give up something. But if you're if the U.S. is negotiating, we've got to give up something too. That's how negotiation works. And so what is the U.S. going to give up? What does Trump want to give up? This is a campaign promise. In my view, he had this campaign rhetoric without any depth of understanding about the policy behind what he's saying. It's a bad deal. It's a bad deal. It's a bad deal. It's the dumbest deal I ever saw. If a reporter or somebody sat down and asked him a second or third layer of question about A, what is the deal, and B, what's wrong with it, could he answer those questions? I don't think so.
So has life improved in Iran since the lifting of sanctions?
I think it has a little bit, not necessarily, because there have been so many trade arrangements between the United States and the Iranians, but the Europeans have had improved relations. So I am, you know, and also, of course, the money that the U.S. government froze has been returned to Iran. So a lot of Americans think that this is money that we gave to Iran as aid. No, it was Iranian money, the Iranian people's money that was frozen in this country for decades has been returned. So
assets,
it was Iranian assets have been returned to the people of Iran.
I'm desperately late for a break. 5 minutes, to be exact. And so let's go do that. We'll come back. We have a couple of letters. We'll get to those. We'll have much more conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Vera Karius-Kelly from Siena College is here, Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, all with us this morning. And we are thrilled that they are, and we're thrilled that you are with us as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. This letter from Martin, who says many people have taken to calling the Trump collusion with Russia as stupid Watergate because the people involved had behaved so brazenly. Trump goes on TV and admits to firing Comey because of the Russia investigation. He then tells the Russian ambassador the same thing in the Oval Office. Trump Jr. gives the New York Times enough emails proving his own collusion with Russia. These people act like this because they believe they are above the law. The GOP-controlled Congress has enabled this, but Mueller will not.
Or maybe they believe it's not wrong. Could that be?
Well, in some cases, there is question as to whether it is wrong and what they've done. So, Michael writes, "You're giving too much credit to Trump and his team. They're not smart enough to devise any useful conspiracy. He's the Russians' useful idiot." Well, that's kind of answers our question before that. Were you going to say something?
No.
Oh, okay. No.
I think on that, I do think there is something to be said for the fact that he does not have a deep philosophical conviction. His conviction is winning, and he's not grounded in strong policy, public policy, knowledge, beliefs, views. And so this is why when somebody like Steve Bannon and the Mercers, you know, looking for somebody who could, you know, lead their cause, they can find some mutual camaraderie there. So the question is then, did the same thing happen with the Russians, that they found some common cause in working with him, either knowingly or unknowingly on the part of him, his family, and his administration? And that's at the heart of what needs to be resolved with the Mueller investigation. But in the meantime, there's a lot of public policy changes that are happening that are very deeply concerning.
We have a couple of other letters. This one from Eric, who says, isn't it true that blowing up the Iran deal is of benefit to Russia?
Possibly, because the Iranians are certainly likely to look for new opportunities and allies. I mean, the Russians and the Iranians already work together in Syria against U.S. interests. So there are lots and lots of interests that the Iranians and Russians have in potentially collaborating. So I'm not sure the Iran nuclear arrangement has divided Russia and Iran. What they have in common is overlapping interests that they pursue anyways, with or without that nuclear arrangement.
Roger writes to this. I'm going to direct this to Teresa because she was just talking about this exact issue. While many in the room might well have been appalled, it appears that a great many Americans were impressed about Trump's speech at the UN. Given Trump's rise in the polls since then, are all these Americans dumb and deplorable?
I agree with him that I had this anecdotal experience in listening on C-SPAN after the speech. There was a live call-in for about, I don't know, a half hour, 40 minutes. And to a person, the callers, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, were supportive of the speech. And so I don't think that they're dumb, and I don't think that they're deplorable. I think that one could hear that speech and say, you know, rah-rah, on America's side, great that somebody's standing up for America, and not realize some of the implications of what Trump was saying and how it's heard around the world, and that it's a venue. I mean, if you listen to President Obama's speech or previous President Bush's speeches there, it is a place where one goes and works on building alliances. That's the purpose of the UN. And certainly if you look around the globe, we need some alliances to deal with a lot of the complex problems we're facing, whether it's in the Middle East or we can't solve the North Korea problem on our own. In fact, we're probably exacerbating it. But so many of these issues, you need to have common cause with your allies, and in some cases, people who you've not been aligned with, you need to build some alliances. So while I can understand that people heard it, but there are a lot of nuances that send a lot of really bad signals to our friends and our enemies.
And I wanted to make a mention of one particular issue that was not really mentioned in the speech that could have actually enhanced President Trump's message of international security, which is the Rohingya catastrophe, the Muslim minority community that is so victimized in Myanmar right now by the Buddhist military regime. It is actually disturbing how much space he left open to radical, violent organizations to go recruiting among victimized Muslim communities that are by the hundreds of thousands attempting to flee an extremely repressive and violent military regime across the border to Bangladesh. There seems to be very little interest in helping refugees. There seems to be very little understanding of the messaging and how important that messaging could be to, the global community. I'm sure lots of subcommittees at the UN are addressing it right now, but this particular issue is reverberating through the world community right now, and President Trump doesn't seem to understand that particular moments like that are sort of inscribing directions for administrations, especially at a talk at the UN.
You know, I'm watching the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, and you know, it's interesting.
How hard is that to watch? Good Lord!
But you know, you listen to it, and you talk about the spirit the of Americans at that point was we were going to solve a big world problem. Mm-hmm. You know, we were going to contain communism, and you know, you had these young men who were enlisting and going over there and offer this noble good, and it was a generational thing that that followed World War II. And you have to wonder what happened to that spirit. Did Vietnam kill it, or has the right wing media encouraged this insular approach to our view of the world? What's happening in terms of how we're educating people about America's role in the global community?
Well, I think
we're gonna have to. Can I pause you there?
Absolutely.
I have to pause you there. So I asked it as a question, but
I
have to admit, no, I don't. I have to do it.
We're done.
If you want to just know the pressure I'm under, just look at Ray's face. Ray Graff
is going to give us some happy news.
He's going to give us some news. Sure. Look at the man. He just exudes happiness. That's right. We'll be right back after this. Good idea. Good idea. We were just talking about we have some topics we didn't get to today, and Teresa said, well, let's just have a lightning round of outrage at the end. Well, we may do that, Teresa. I may give you your wish. We'll see if I can pull that together in the next 15, 20 minutes. Here's some letters from our listeners, and then we will move on to this will be a good subject for you for outrage, but it will for on healthcare. We'll talk about that. Susie writes, Ty Cobb has said that the White House will comply with all requests from the Mueller team. McGahn seems reluctant to do so, and I'm wondering why.
Oh, I know why.
Okay.
Because it's McGahn is the White House counsel, and Ty Cobb, not the ball player, is the outside counsel. And so McGahn has an obligation to protect not just President Trump, but the presidency. And this has gone not just Republican presidents, Democrats as well, that you, by providing some information, is that creating a future legal problem for presidents? The issue is most frequently around the ability to have confidential conversations with your staff, where the information won't. It's a privacy. It's a presidential
executive privilege
issue.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We also got this letter from Maureen who says, here's my take after some obsessive reading. Trump needed money a decade ago, and he did shady, probably illegal real estate deals with Russia oligarchs that allowed them to launder money. They are holding this over him and the Trump organization and family. They try to call in their chips with connections through Page, Manafort, Cohen, etc. All the furious obstruction makes sense.
Quite likely.
Well, that's the heart of the Mueller investigation. Is there a quid pro quo here? Mm-hmm. Was there something that was done that was illegal?
But can I just? But nobody thought, including them, right, that he was going to win.
Well, that not nobody. They thought they were going to win.
Well, I'm guessing my point being that
I feared they might win.
Okay, but my question being that if all of this is true, and this narrative, which I agree makes great sense, is that even holding it over the head, it wouldn't have mattered. They would have an influence in the election one way or the other, right? Is that
the Russians, you have to remember, are long-term players. They don't get involved over a couple of years and then hope for immediate outcomes. They have been attempting to meddle in numerous European elections for at least a decade. So let's think of it that way. Had they not gained sufficient foothold this time around, they certainly have built up their connections. And Kislyak, the famous Russian ambassador to the U.S., was an exceptionally skilled diplomat and intelligence officers, and his connections are very wide, and he was in this country for a decade. So just think of them as long-term players.
But I think it's possible, I guess to this letter, it's possible that the Russians colluded I mean, that the Russians were involved in the U.S. elections, trying to influence the outcome of the elections. The question is, did the Trump administration collude in that effort? And then the next layer of question is, did they do it wittingly or unwittingly? So the intelligence community has affirmed that the Russians were involved in trying to influence the U.S. elections, both in setting the tone through the Facebook, purchasing of Facebook ads and so on and so forth, and through hacking into state voter files and things of that sort, both so to influence voter views and possibly trying to affect the voter, the votes.
Well, how about looking at it another way, though? If Ty Cobb, the lawyer, is saying, you know, let's give them as many documents as they want, let's cooperate as much as they want, maybe they don't have anything to hide.
Let's go to this letter from Jim, and then we'll move on to healthcare. Actually, I have two letters here. Jim writes, "Hey, panel, Trump stupid about the deal? It was the Obama folks who left no negotiating positions, such as giving back half of the frozen assets. Who is stupid in deals? I think not Trump, who is critical of it for many reasons. A very bad deal."
Well, I think that remember that the deal was negotiated not between the U.S. and the Iranians. It was negotiated across
the UK, Germany, France, Russia, China, and the U.S., and largely the entire European Union was involved. So it is a multipolar negotiation. So decisions were not made by just the U.S., and so therefore, I'm not really sure what else to say except
the
for
UN
the fact.
Well, it could still be a bad deal even with all those parties involved.
Well, we can choose not to have any agreements and then have a country like Iran act outside of all international boundaries and have something like another North Korean situation, or we can decide to establish some parameters within which we can curtail, call to task, and challenge the Iranians. So that's the options we have.
Then this letter, Mike, says, "Since its inception, the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of the United Nations has always been dependent on the willingness of its members to honor and implement resolutions. If a nation perceives a resolution to not be in their national interest, they will not adhere to it. Sovereignty of individual members has never been questioned." We thank you for your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We have about 10 minutes left. I want to get to the health bill and where we are right now. Republicans are voting to repeal Obamacare, but do they have the votes? That's the big question here. Do they have the votes in both the House and the Senate? One GOP senator has indicated opposition to the bill. That would be Rand Paul from Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Three others have expressed concerns with the bill: Susan Collins of Maine, John McCain of Arizona, and Senator Murkowski from Alaska. If three vote against it, the bill would fail. And this bill in question, the Cassidy-Graham plan, which we've been talking about in great detail over the course of this week, it would dissolve the ACA marketplaces, slash Medicaid funding, and give almost all of the federal money propping up Obamacare to states to create health programs as they wish. Teresa, you have maintained that you think this bill could pass.
I still think it could pass. Because I think the underlying driver of this is two things. One is to meet their campaign pledge of repeal and replace. But most importantly, they want to pass a tax bill. And to pass a tax bill, they need money to pay for their tax cuts that are primarily reportedly targeted to the top 1%. And to get that, you either need to pass this repeal and replace, or you need to go after corporate welfare, or you need to have a bill, a tax package, or you need to cut deeply into Medicare and Medicaid, or you need to have a tax proposal that's not paid for. And so there are few options, and I think they're turning back to this plan because they see this is one of the paths toward A, keeping their promise about repealing and placing, and B, paying for their tax cuts. But the price of that, the price of that is that millions, some estimate 30 plus million people will lose access to health care coverage, that this block grants funding, that it ends the protections for people with pre-existing conditions, it ends the cap, the lifetime cap on costs, it ends the essential benefits, you know, what's in the basic package of coverage that you have. It cuts deeply into Medicaid, 31% cut in Medicaid for children, 15%+ cut in approximately Medicaid for the elderly. That's mostly people in nursing homes. This will fundamentally change the way people get or don't get health care coverage, and not just the people who get coverage through the ACA right now, but across the board. Your access and affordability of health care will change dramatically if this passes, and it may.
I think most Americans are surprised this is even back on the table. They thought Congress was going to be incredibly busy all September trying to resolve the debt limit and, you know, get a budget in place. But I almost think that the agreement Trump made with the Democrats kind of cleared the way for health care to come back. And, you know, there's not a lot of time left in September, and this has to be done by September 30th if it's going to happen. This has the same problems for me in terms of transparency. Nobody really knows what's, I mean, the American public doesn't know what's in it. There haven't been hearings. This is a particular issue for John McCain when he voted no the last time.
Right.
And also think about the environment. I'm sorry, did you?
No, I was just thinking the fact alone that the health insurance industry has come out and cautioned against this bill for fear of having absolute chaos in the health market is one of those indicators that we have not had public discussions, that we have not figured out how much it's going to cost, who's going to be affected in which way. We simply haven't had the necessary public conversation involvement of the American public. I mean, aren't we a liberal democracy where people get to hear what proposals, how proposals might impact their lives in the near future? Well, one wonders with this particular bill once again.
Yeah, philosophically, I think there are people who would say, yeah, it's a great idea for the states to decide for themselves how to spend their health care dollars. But New York State was going to take a huge hit because with the decision comes far fewer dollars from the federal government. And that really money helps makes decisions in huge ways.
Yeah. And think about it. The other thing that it doesn't account for is disasters, public health emergencies, things of that sort. So if you block grant, give everybody, every state a finite amount of money to provide health care in their states in the way they choose, then what happens if you're Texas and or Florida, if you're Texas and
or Puerto
Hurricane
Rico.
Harvey has devastated your communities, and so people don't have their jobs anymore because the place that they were working for no longer exists, and so they have to get health care in a different way. And how do you fund that? Or what if you're Florida, or what if you're Puerto Rico, or it just for those who this is not just campaign rhetoric, there's some people who philosophically believe in this, and they believe that the federal government should not have a role in health care and that you should leave it to the markets. And so this gets to the core issue. Is health care a fundamental right, or is it a privilege? And if people who vote for this bill are saying that access to health care is a privilege in the United States, not a right, it's just going to be for those like Jimmy Kimmel, as he himself says, and go listen to what he said again last night. It will just be for those who can afford it.
But from a political perspective, if this fails again, this is carry great political costs for the Republicans. I can imagine Trump will work with the Democrats more and more.
I'm just curious what kind of a model we might be enhancing if this bill passes. So if we have a lot of people without health insurance and the bottom falls out, are people going to emergency rooms once again and private industry pay for people? Do we increase taxes? I mean, somebody will have to pay, or are we living in a country where when you can't afford health care, hospital door will close and they'll say, find somebody else to take care of it? I mean, this is the most expensive way through which you deliver health care to a nation.
And what happens to their whole network in states that have been aggressive, Ohio, New York, Colorado, California, other states that have been aggressive about Massachusetts, about insuring the uninsured? One of the things, there has been an outgrowth of community-based clinics. Mm-hmm. So rather than the emergency room, you go to a clinic which is less expensive. Well, now there's not going to be reimbursement for that. What about, you know, they say they care about the opioid crisis. This will decimate, absolutely decimate the drug treatment infrastructure, which was weak to begin with. What about mental health for our veterans? What's the effect of that going to be on the just, will there be a system in which they, I know that they get veterans care, that's separate from this, but you still have to have an infrastructure of professionals. And so this will really restructure 1/6 of our economy. And even if this doesn't pass, the process of this in combination with the introduction of the single payer by independent Senator Bernie Sanders, the side thing is that this has blown up the effort that was going on to put together a bipartisan fix for the things that are wrong with the Affordable Care Act. Republicans and Democrats, they held 2 weeks of hearings. There were more scheduled this week. They were working to try to figure out what patches they could make to strengthen it. And that's now, the chairman of the committee yesterday said, off the table.
We have about 2 minutes and four letters, so let's try to get to as many as we can. Angela writes, good morning, panel. What an insightful conversation. Thank you for helping me understand the Iran deal and for shedding light on how the United States is coming off on the world stage. Dan says, America hasn't ever influenced elections in other countries. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. About as silly as global warming when we can't control our population growth. We're doomed. Now, panel, say this and make us feel good about being doomed.
The Russians are here.
Tom writes, the idea that if 45 were subject to a deeper layer of questioning about the Iran deal, he would look like an ignoramus is spot on. I feel the same way about his and most other opponents' understanding of Medicare for all. I wish we could make a deal that if he couldn't coherently describe his problems with Sanders' plan, he wouldn't be allowed to veto it. And Anna writes, hello, you most informed and articulate panel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Hello, you wonderful listener.
I realize you've moved on from the discussion of Iran, but could you quickly comment on diplomatic and is it Rouhani's? Rouhani's diplomatic and moderate speech in contrast to Trump's.
Oh, well, Rouhani is, considered a moderate in Iran. I mean, we still look at him as, you know, pretty conservative in his outlook, but he's better than what we have had before. He, of course, publicly responded to Trump's speech at the UN saying, we're not renegotiating, we're not going back to the table. His image that he used, I think, was, if you have a building and you remove a pillar from that building, it will collapse. So in other words, he's pushing back really hard, saying, I am not going back to renegotiate anything.
But it was a measured, tempered...
Yes, I mean, he was not bombastic in his response, because he has learned. I mean, these leaders in Iran, they are, you know, very experienced on the world stage. They are not explosive. They do not pound their fist on the table. Since Ahmadinejad, he was, you know, something else. But, you know, in recent years, in the past sort of decade, they have really worked on improving the public image of Iran by behaving in ways that are more typical of diplomatic interactions.
We are out of time. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning, our most esteemed and articulate panel, I believe was how they said it.
Call the Congress.
Daily
Save healthcare.
Oh, I thought you wanted to tell how articulate you were. Daily Gazette editor Judy Patrick, Vera Carias Kelly, professor of political science at Siena College, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. Thank you all for being here. A great pleasure. We'll be back right after this.